So now we'll go over to our Igelet Rav Shira Gaon. If you recall what we had seen thus far, the people had asked Rav Shira Gaon, why is it that the sages that appear in the Gemara are primarily the sages of the later generations? What about the earlier generations? So Rav Shira Gaon began by discussing Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rebbe. If you recall, we discussed last week why he was called Rabbeinu HaKadosh. He compiled the 6 tractates of the Mishnah. And we cannot add on to them, we cannot detract from them. Therefore, the Gemara says, Amar Rava Matai Sudra Mishnah. Rava said, when was the Mishnah compiled? In the days of Rebbe. Notice that the Gemara he's quoting, the verse that he's quoting, doesn't say that Rebbe compiled it. It says it was compiled in Rebbe's days. There are other places where the Gemara seems to say Rebbe is the one that compiled it. Vishishaltim. That which you asked, Madua Shiwa Chachmim Yoshnim Tova Mishnah Lachonim, why is it that the Tanoim that we encounter in the Mishnah are primarily the later generations? Hem Lo Yishirut. That's not that the earlier generations had no opinion. Ela Kol Lachonim Lamdu Divrei Rishonim VeTamim. First thing we have to know is that everything that was learned in the time of the Mishnah, they were learning what their predecessors had said. Meaning the earlier generations all learned Mishnah, as we discussed in the past. From Moshe Rabbeinu's time, they had an oral law, and everyone was studying it. And now he's going to quote to us a story, which we're going to look up in the Gemara. The Gemara in Pesachim, we'll quote it by heart. The Gemara quotes the following story. The leaders of the Jewish people at the time were named Bnei Bisera, and they were the Nasiim. And Pesach came along, and the 14th, when we have to bring the Paschal offering, fell out on Shabbos. So they were asked, do we bring a Paschal offering on Shabbos? And these great leaders said, we don't know, we don't remember. And they started searching, is there anyone that remembers, can you bring a Paschal offering on Shabbos? And they were told, there's this poor man who came from Babylon, who learned by the great leaders Shmaya and Avtalion, and he'll know the answer. So they send word, and they call this poor man named Hillel, who's a very modest person, and they tell him, do you know whether a Paschal offering can be brought on Shabbos? So he told them, 200 times a year we bring the Paschal offering on Shabbos, and you're asking about one Paschal offering? Meaning, he said, every Shabbos we bring 3 korbanos, even though it's Shabbos. We bring the tamid in the morning and in the afternoon, just like we do every day, because the Torah says so, and we bring a musaf. So it's 3 sacrifices, 4 sacrifices, every Shabbos, and that you have no questions on. So why do we do that on Shabbos? Because the Pasuk says that you do it b'mo'ado, in its set time. If I'm not mistaken, that's the drush over there in the Gemara. So in its set time, overrules Shabbos. So Pesach also says should be done in its set time. So just like you have no question, every Shabbos you bring the other commandments, you bring the Pesach. They saw that he knew the answer, they didn't. They said, we're stepping down, you're becoming the Nasi. You're the leader. And this is something that happened many times. There's a famous story that there were 4 Gaonim. During the period of the Gaonim, slightly after the Gemara, they were traveling on a ship, and pirates captured the ship. And these great sages were on the ship. They took them to different cities, and they knew that they were big rabbis, so they knew the Jewish community would redeem them, and they sold them at different port cities. And the fact that these 4 great sages were captured changed the course of history. No, this is long before the Rambam. This is about 500 years before the Rambam. Because when these rabbis reached the different cities throughout Europe, they spread the Torah learning. The story goes that one of them was sitting in shul, and the rabbi was teaching Mishnayos, and he started teaching a Mishnah, and he misread the Mishnah. So he tried to figure out how the Mishnah works, Mishnah and Yuma, and he couldn't make heads or tails of it. So he's sitting there, he's one of the greatest sages of all time. And he tells him what Pshat is. So the rabbi said, I see you know much better than me. Now you're rabbi of the community. And he became the rabbi. And he set up a yeshiva.
What was this?
I don't remember which city it was in.
What? Which place did they go? Because it spread around.
They were spread out throughout Europe. I don't remember the names of the cities. It's on that chart somewhere. They're known as the four Gonim. Four Gonim is famous that they were scattered. So this happened not only in Hillel's time, but many times when people saw someone else was greater, they said, "You take the throne. I shouldn't be rabbi here. You know more than me." So that's what happened here. The Bnei Bisera, the Nasim, saw that Hillel knew better than them. So they appointed him Nasi. So he was giving a speech all Shabbos long, preparing people for Pesach. And at some point he said, "You know why I'm sitting up here and not you? Because you were all lazy. You had Shmaya and Naphtali and out in Babylon, and all of you felt like, why should I take the journey to go learn by them? If any of you would have gone there to learn by them, you would have been the great leaders too. Why am I sitting up here and not you?" So he gave them the speech, trying to get them to understand that they should have learned better. But our sages say that there was an element of haughtiness in what he said. So our sages say that whenever a person is slightly haughty, so God makes him forget. Either if he's a prophet, he loses his prophecy. If he's a wise sage, he loses part of his wisdom. So the next question one of the people ask him is, "Well, on Sabbath, if we forget to bring the knife, are we allowed to carry the knife to shecht the Paschal offering? You said we're allowed to bring the Paschal offering, but what about carrying the knife?" So he forgot. He said, "You know, I learned this, but I don't remember." And our sages say this happened to him because he had spoken to them so harshly. So he said, "But don't worry. The Jewish people, if they themselves aren't prophets, their forefathers are prophets. You'll see they'll figure out the right answer." And that's what happened. That Shabbos, the people who forgot their knives, those who brought sheep, stuck the knives into the wool of the sheep and let the sheep carry it. And those who brought rams that they don't have wool, they hung it between the ram's horns, and that's how they brought it. And when Hillel was standing outside waiting to see what the Jews would do, he said, "Oh, now I remember, that's the halacha Shmaya and Naftalion taught me. That's really the halacha, the way they behaved." So now, what is Rav Shira Gaon coming to prove with that story? He's saying, you see that Hillel, who is quoted in the Mishnah, he attributes all his knowledge to his predecessors. He's saying, "Why am I sitting up here being the Nasi, not you? Because I went to learn by Shmaya and Naftalion, the two great leaders." So Rav Shira Gaon is saying, you ask me how come Shmaya and Naftalion don't show up throughout the Mishnah. The reason, he says, firstly is we see even Hillel and Shammai, and the same thing is true for everyone else, what they were learning is what their predecessors said. This is the way things worked. The earlier sages were not identified by their name. The only ones who we do encounter are the Nasi, the prince, the head, the Av Betin, and the one who headed the court. Because there was no machlokas. Because up until Shammai and Hillel, everyone agreed. We'd have the same tradition. Sometimes we'd have differences. We'd sit down, talk it out, prove to one another, and there was no machlokas. So what are you going to say? This is my opinion? Well, it's his opinion, and the next guy's opinion, it's everyone's opinion. So you can't quote something in the name of anyone specific because there was a consensus. Everyone agreed on what the oral law said. So that's why you don't encounter any private names, any personal names, until the generation of Hillel and Shammai, because until that generation there was no argument. The hefer, quite the contrary. Pirusha Mishnah v'Torah, yudim nem deviru. They understood the Mishnah and the Torah very clearly. Gama Talmud Ayidolem, also the Gemara. What?
How can you be using the term they were using the Mishnah? The Mishnah is a compilation. It's when it was codified, when it was put down, the oral law became written.
So the word Mishnah comes from the word Shanui, said over or repeated. And the Mishnah existed from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. We have some Mishnayos that are still the exact verse the way Moshe gave it. Mishnah existed from the time Torah was given. God gave the written law together with an oral law. And Moshe taught the written law and he taught the oral law. The written law was written and the oral law was not. And each generation studied it. It was memorized. We will encounter that they used to keep a rough draft. Each person used to have a rough draft that he wrote down of the oral law that wasn't published. The Mishnah that Rebbe compiled was published and spread out. But each disciple, when he'd learn, would keep his own version of the oral law written, stashed away somewhere. And they wouldn't publicize it. That was just in case he forgot something, he'd look back to that. That's the later generations. So he's discussing why aren't the earlier generations, why don't we find any generation prior to Hillel and Shammai in the Mishnah? The earliest generation we find in Mishnah are Hillel and Shammai. Everything before Hillel and Shammai, all we encounter are the Nasi and Av Bezdin. The Mishnah in Avos quotes Shmaya and Avtana, quotes the Nesim and the Av Beis Din. We don't find any other Tana quoted throughout the Mishnah. Rarely will you find the Akavya ben Malalel or any other opinion from Tanakh.
We cannot call something from the Rosh Rabbeinu's time Mishnah.
Because it was oral law. Mishnah means the oral law. The oral law which summarizes laws, which was repeated and memorized. It took on a specific form in Rebbe's time. The specific form which was exemplary of the most accurate form which had boiled down in Rebbe's time. And obviously, what he's going to explain is that as the generations continued from Hillel and Shammai, then we do start having differences of opinion. That's why we do start having opinions quoted. Until Hillel and Shammai, there was no point in quoting an opinion because everyone had the same opinion. So you can't attribute it to anyone specific. It's only after Hillel and Shammai that you start having machlokas, and now he's going to explain why. The Talmud, the Gemara, the reasonings of the Mishnah, they also knew very clearly. They used to learn the Mishnah very, very well, and when they'd have a new question pop up, so they'd look into it and come to a conclusion. The Gemara quotes the following story. We're going to look that up.
Do we have a Gemara here?
Yeah. Okay. Gemara quotes the following statement, which you guys should be familiar with. We mentioned it in the past, and now hopefully everyone will remember it. The Gemara quotes like this. Tanu Rabbanan. We have a Tanaic quote that's of a good nature, a good source. Tanu Rabbanan is the rabbis learned, it means literally, but it's an introduction to a braisa that we have a good tradition on. 80 talmidim ayu lo lehilel hazaken. Hillel, we just discussed, he's called Hillel hazaken. He had 80 disciples. 30 mehem, 30 of those disciples, ruyim shetishra lehen shechina. They are fitting that the shechina, that they should have prophecy ke Moshe Rabbeinu. They're on the level they could have prophecy like Moshe. He had 30 students who were so great. So why didn't they? No one's asking me. Because the generation wasn't fit for it. Because in order for someone to be on Moshe's level, he's affected by the people around him. God only appears to a leader who's fit and a generation who's fit. Here the leaders were fit, but the generation was not. A different time. Okay? No, remind me. It's not for now. 30 men ruyim shtamod lehem chama ki Yoshua binun. 30 were on the level that they could make the sun stop, like Yoshua. Yeshua made the sun stop. They were on that high level that theoretically they could make the sun stop. Eslim benonim, and that 20 were mediocre. They weren't from these tops. Gadol shebechulan, the top one was Yonatan ben Uziel, the famous Yonatan ben Uziel who wrote the translation to the Nevim, to the prophets. Katan shebechulan, the smallest disciple was Chaban Yochanan ben Zakkai. The famous Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ultimately was the Nasi. Amwal aval Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the smallest disciple of Hillel, who was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, they used to say about him, shelo niach mikra, he didn't leave over, meaning he had full control of the whole Tanakh, the whole Mishnah, the whole Gemara, all of Halacha, all of Agada, all the stories in the Gemara, dikdukei Torah, to be able to learn out from each letter that's written in the Torah why it's written this way and that way. Dikdukei Sofrim, to know all the rabbinic institutions down to the T. Vekalin vechamurin vegzirot shavot vetkufot, you know how to figure out how to make a calendar if there was no one else around, you know how to figure out exactly the constellations and when the moon, you'd have a new moon and everything else. Gematriot, you knew how to figure out from numeric values all kinds of things in the Torah. Umshalot kochavim. So now we're getting into things which are a little difficult to explain. They're Kabbalistic concepts. It means Mishalot Kochavim, Mishalot Shualim. These are things which the Gemara is going to explain, that there are ways of speaking to Sichat Shedim, speaking to demons, Sichat Bekalim, speaking to palm trees, Sichat Malachei Asharet, the speech of the different angels, Davar Gadot, Davar Katan. Even big things, small things, he had full control of everything. This is the smallest disciple of Hillel. What's a big thing? That's Maaseh Merkava. What's a small thing? The things that Abaye and Rav and the Gemara have difficulty trying to understand. So, he had full control over everything, and he was the smallest disciple, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. From here we see, what?
Sounds like
a good school. Good school, yeah, good students and a good rabbi, yeah. From here we see, says Rav Shir Agon, that the questions of Abaye and Rava, the Gemara says, in Hillel's time, in the time of the Mishnah, everyone had full control of them. So, it's not like we thought until now, that Gemara is an exposition that began in the Amoraic period, but rather this is something that existed all along, but everyone knew it. So long as the temple was around, each rabbi would teach a student. You'd walk into a rabbi, so he'd start rattling off, teaching you the oral law. Now, the oral law is complicated. I once gave someone an example. Let's say you're sitting in a classroom and you see the rabbi takes a cup to drink, a cup of water, and he makes a shehakol. So he makes a blessing, shehakol niyevi dvaro. So what can you derive from there? So two people could walk out and each one could say something else. One can say, okay, anytime you drink something you make a shehakol. Another one will say, no, anytime you drink water you make a shehakol. And both will be wrong. Why are both wrong? So let's see. It's true that most drinks are shehakol, but grape juice or wine is going to be bor priagafen, right? It's true that usually when you drink water, you make a shehakol. But let's say you drink water and you're not thirsty, you're just drinking it to down a pill. You need to take a pill. So we say if you drink something that has a flavor, so you make a shehakol because you enjoy the flavor. But if you're drinking water to down a pill, you want to take some kind of pill, and you're not thirsty, so you just need it to get the pill down your throat, so then the water has no flavor. So you're not gaining from it because you weren't thirsty, and you're not gaining the flavor. So then you don't make a blessing on the water. So both students didn't get it 100% right. So here we sat and we discussed this for 3 minutes, 2 minutes, and now we know the halacha. Most drinks are going to be a shehakol, and water is only a shehakol when you drink it out of thirst, not to down something else. But you understand that in order to pass even such a simple law, you have to sit and explain a lot. And in order for us to have a situation where generations didn't have an argument, it means that they sat and learned by their rabbis for a long time. They got all these halachas down pat. We didn't discuss what happens when you make a pirei. You don't really water. You're not taking, let's say, carrots and you're making carrot juice, but rather you're making like carrot soup. We didn't discuss what's going to be if you plant something for the sole purpose of making juice out of it, then it might have a blessing, bori priyais, the juice. There's a long discussion why our orange juice is a shehakol. All the orange groves are planted for the sake of the juice. So the juice is the purpose of the grove. So then some opinions say that an orange juice you should make a bori priyais. We don't go that way. The majority opinion says you make a shehakol, but it's not really clear why. So we didn't cover all the halachos, but we covered some of them. Yeah. What? Oh, we didn't cover that either. Right, so there are going to be many questions. What happens if you take syrup? You're taking medication, and they give it cherry flavor. So you enjoy the flavor. Do you make a shehakol? No, because you're not drinking that. You're taking something which is not edible, that had an added flavor. So even though the flavor tastes good, that doesn't make it a drink. It's still something that's not edible that was given a good flavor. At the end of the day, if a person takes a cough medicine, he's not going to make a shehakol. So obviously we didn't cover everything. This isn't the class in halacha. That was just an example. So when we say that every generation till the time of Hillel and Shammai there were no arguments, means they were all able to sit down and learn by their rabbis and get all the details of each halacha. So long as the Beis Mikdash was around, each rabbi, each chacham, would teach his students the reasonings of the Torah. He'd use his own words, Rav Shiragon says. There was no set form how to teach. You'd come in and he'd teach it. And he'd teach and teach and teach and teach. As long as you could listen, he'd teach. They used to learn from sunrise to sunset. Like, and beyond. The kids learned all year long. Yom Kippur, they'd get off a little bit to prepare for Yom Kippur. But in general, the students learned every day of the year. You have Zilberman, the school in the Jewish quarter, where they go that way. On Shabbos, you also have classes. So each Rebbe would teach in his own style. And there was a lot of wisdom going around. And they weren't too busy with anything. They could sit and learn and focus. There was one machlokas throughout the generations about a detail of a certain sacrifice, how you lean on that sacrifice. That was the one machlokas that existed throughout the generations until Hillel and Shammai. That's it. Everything else everyone agreed on. When Shammai and Hillel came along, so they had three disagreements. The Gemara says that Shammai and Hillel differed on three things. But their students, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, they had many, many differences. Now here we enter the period where Machlokas begins. And before we continue with Rav Shiragon, we're going to see a Gemara in Sanhedrin. So let's get a Gemara in Sanhedrin.
I'm curious about something. I remember that, like, you know, back when we had the Sanhedrin, there were, you know, legal disputes, and, you know, Sanhedrin decided the law this way or that. So right. What is the difference between saying there's a difference in some sort of legal opinion and the Sanhedrin deciding the law, and saying there's actually a disagreement in the oral law? What is the difference between those two statements?
So Rav Shiragon didn't deal with that point, and we're going to have to see if we can find an allusion to that as he continues. Because it seems, we find, for example, that when David HaMelech came onto the scene, so there was a discussion, is he fit to marry, to be a king? Is he fit to be a Jew? His great-great-grandmother was Rus, the Moabite. So there was a discussion, and there was a disagreement, but they could go to the High Court, and the High Court ruled. Yeah. For some reason, Rav Shiragon isn't addressing that now. I don't know why. If I were writing this letter, so I'd include that point that you're raising. But I don't know why he chose to leave that out. He's saying, like, everyone agreed on everything, and they'd figure out what the answer is, and he's not addressing the High Court. It seems like I agree with you. That's what I would say too. I don't know why he left it out. That part of the reason they didn't have machlokas is because they had a body that could decide what the halacha is. We find in the first temple they said the libation, the nisach hayayin, should be done one way. Came along people of the second temple and they said, no, from now on the halacha is the other way. What does that mean? That means that throughout the period of the first temple they weren't doing nisach hayayin correctly? They never brought a sacrifice correctly? Doesn't mean that. It means that the court in the time of the first temple ruled one way, and the court in the time of the second temple overruled them. They're not saying they were wrong, they're saying we ruled differently. We rule that. If someone does it today, he's wrong. But you understand?
But they are ruling. I'm sorry, when there's a certain bechira, and you go one way, you immediately say, but my way is more right than the other way.
Oh, so I.
It is a question of how can there be difference of feeling there? They're both right. It could also be the same.
So you're asking how do we say elu velu divrei Elokim chayim? We have a concept that when we have two opinions, they both have. We say they're both godly.
I mean, the explanation that I think you're giving in some other words, on the concept that Torah is here in earth and we are shaping it.
That's part of it, but I'll tell you what, we could expand on it, but then we'll be saying a conglomerate of opinions, meaning we have to put together a lot of sources in order to answer that. And on a Thursday night, I don't mind doing it. I just feel like if we do it here, we'll lose the understanding of Rav Shiragon. I think it's important to understand what he's telling us. After that, at a different class, I'd be happy to address it. I'm just scared that if we address it now, we'll get confused between what he's saying and what other people are saying. Now, Rav Shiragon over here makes an interesting statement. We know there was a city of Beitar. And we know that in that city, Bar Kochava fought. Bar Kochava was the leader who came along after the destruction of the Second Temple and said, we could win the Romans, let's go fight. And he had an amazing army. Now, it's unclear how many of our sages went with Bar Kochava. The Gemara seems to say Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was of the opinion, we have to go with Bar Kochava, he's the Messiah. And he sent his men, they went with Bar Kokhba. According to some opinions, that's where his disciples, his thousands of disciples died. But the Jerusalem Talmud and the Rambam and Rav Shirgon seems to be saying that here, they all seem to say that the majority of the rabbis went with Bar Kokhba. The Rambam writes that the majority of rabbis backed Bar Kokhba. They hoped he would be the Messiah. Turned out he wasn't the Messiah. The Rav Shirgon over here writes that when the temple was destroyed, the sages all went to Beitar. And that's not recorded in our Talmud. It's not recorded that all the sages went to Beitar. We know that when Beitar was destroyed, the Romans had held such hatred to the Jews for having fought that bitter war. They lost so many legions at Beitar that they wouldn't let the bodies be buried. For a long period, they left the bodies there to rot, and the blood reached the Jerusalem Talmud describes how many vineyards they watered with the blood from the dead of the city of Beitar. And then when they finally permitted us to go and bury the bodies, there was a great miracle that the bodies hadn't rotted. Instead of being eaten by animals or rotting, the bodies remained intact. And our sages saw this great miracle and they instituted a blessing. They said, from now on, if you're drinking wine and they bring a better wine to the table, you make a blessing. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Atov VeAmitiv. God who's good and he does good to others. And that the good and does good to others, they meant, would imply, would also refer to those dead of Beitar. Now the fourth blessing in Birkat HaMazon, they also instituted. And their initial institution was after Uvnei Yerushalayim Yerkosh Mimra V'Amenu Baruch Ata Hashem Bonev Rachma V'Yerushalayim Amen Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Atov VeAmitiv. End of benching. Over the generations, that blessing got longer and longer and longer till it's the length that we have it today. But the initial institution was that it's an identical blessing. Yeah, Jeff.
I was just wondering if you could expand on that bracha when you use it.
What, Atov HaMetiv? In general, when you're drinking one wine, and then afterwards they bring a better wine to the table. That's the time you say, yeah.
What if your opinion that the wine is not better? What do you mean by better?
I think it goes... Okay, I have to look it up. I don't want to answer you. I don't remember it clearly. I want to look it up. Yeah, we have to go to mine. So we'll continue with you next week.